Iraqi resistance group says its war with the United States will have no limits from now on, and that following U.S. air raids on Iraq and Syria. Iran denounces as shameful the discoveries of unmarked graves of indigenous people in Canada. It calls for an international investigation. Several South Asian countries, Australia and Russia, impose restrictions to contain the spread of a highly contagious variant of COVID-19. Starting with Iraq, and a resistance group has promised to shoot down any American hostile airplane following U.S. air raids inside Iraq and Syria. A faction operating under Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit says that the war with the U.S. will have no limits from now on. The group says that the first step would be targeting hostile aircraft flying over Iraq. Iran has slammed the attack, saying they are a continuation of America's failed policy in the region. The U.S. Defense Department says its early Monday strikes hit operational and weapons storage facilities at a location in Iraq and two others in Syria. It says the air raids were in response to attacks on U.S. interests in Iraq. According to the Pentagon, the strikes were directed by President Joe Biden. These are the second such attacks under the Biden administration, and they come amid growing calls in Iraq for the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces from the country. Mohammed Ali says that a child has been killed in the U.S. air raids that have hit residential buildings near the Iraq-Syria border.
So according to Syrian state media, at about 1 a.m. Local time here in Syria, fighter jets believed to be American attacked residential apartments near a town called Al Bukamal, which is on the borderline between Syria and Iraq. Now, the attack, according to Sana, officially the state media over here, state news agency, the attack killed one child and injured three other civilians, as well as it caused material damage to those apartments, residential areas over there near Al Bukamal.
The author and activist Yves Engler says that the U.S. has no right whatsoever to kill people in Syria under the pretext of self-defense.
The U.S. has no right to be killing and bombing people in Syria. And if it's going to do that, it certainly shouldn't be justifying that as defense. So, yes, obviously, if there was a child killed, which some reports are suggesting, that's obviously terrible. And it just adds to a long list of children, civilians, women who have been killed by the U.S. in Syria, in Iraq, and in so many different countries. I think that the U.S. has at times clearly supported ISIS and has, you know, enabled them to grow, and I don't think that the U.S.'s primary objective right now is definitely not about ISIS. It's about controlling the region, and it's, I think, a bit of a competition or geopolitical battle with Iran. It's about weakening Assad. It's about controlling oil. I mean, in Syria, I mean, American troops, about 1,000 U.S. troops are still just controlling, and this is explicit, they're not even hiding it, we're just keeping control of Syrian oil.
Protest rallies raging in the occupied West Bank over the death of Nizar Banat, an outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority, who died in the custody of PA forces on Thursday. Mona Kendall reports.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy saying that Banat took blows to the head and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Tehran has denounced as shameful genocide the discovery of mass graves in Canada's former residential schools for Indigenous children. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatib Zada says the Canadian government has to accept the responsibility for the crime and be held accountable for that. It says Canada has always pretended to be a defender of human rights, but now it's trying to divert attention from its dark history of human rights with false claims. Khatib Zada says Iran and several other countries demand a UN-monitored probe into the issue, as the Canadian government lacks the qualification to conduct such an investigation. Now, that reaction came after the discovery of multiple mass graves at sites of two church-run schools in Canada in recent weeks. The graves contained remains of nearly 1,000 Indigenous students. The Yemeni army says it's launched a major missile and drone attack against sensitive military targets inside Saudi Arabia's southern region. Army spokesman General Yahya Saria says that the missile force and air force performed the joint operation using five ballistic missiles and as many drones. The strikes hit a National Guard compound in the city of Najran, military positions in Abha International Airport, and King Khalid Air Base in the city of Khamis Mashhad. The general added that missiles and drones hit the designated targets with precision. The Yemeni army carries out such retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to a deadly war. Speaking of Yemen, the country has again slammed the UN for what it calls double standard as regards the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
Children and Armed Conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Some 30 people have been killed in an attack by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group on a town in Somalia, semi-autonomous state of Galmudug. A security official says the group used two car bombs in the assault on a military base. They said the terrorists also engaged in fierce fighting with government troops and locals. Armed residents in the town reportedly reinforced the base and chased the Al-Shabaab members. Officials say 17 soldiers and 13 civilians were killed. The government has condemned the attack and said that more than 40 terrorists were killed. The Al-Shabaab group frequently performs gun and bomb assaults on civilian and military targets. Its members have tried to overthrow the government for more than a decade. Let's now take a look at the COVID situation across the world. The spread of the highly contagious Delta variant has prompted renewed restrictions in different parts of the world. Majority of Australian cities have gone under new lockdowns amid the detection of new cases linked to the Delta variant. Several countries in South Asia, including Thailand, Indonesia, and Bangladesh, have tightened curbs. South Africa began a two-week lockdown on Sunday. Russia has also imposed fresh restrictions in the capital, Moscow, amid fears of a new deadly wave of the virus fueled by the new variant. Meanwhile, in Italy, all regions are now allowed to ease health measures once regarded as the epicenter of a pandemic. The European country marked a milestone by removing the obligation for wearing masks on Monday. Well, the UK did the same thing, but Delta is hitting it again. Now, South Africa has announced it will tighten COVID-19 restrictions for 14 days to stem a sharp rise in infections. Authorities highlighted that additional restrictions are necessary as current containment measures aren't sufficient to prevent a surge in the number of cases. Under the new measures, all gatherings will be prohibited. There will be a curfew from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. The wave of COVID-19 infections there has been driven by the spread of the Delta variant, weak countermeasures, and public fatigue with existing restrictions. The overall caseload in South Africa has surpassed 1.9 million. Total fatalities hover around 60,000. Journalist and commentator Julia Sambalutu says that several factors have contributed to the surge in COVID-19 infections in South Africa.
That's a combination of different factors. Of course, you have the Delta variant, which is a key thing, which they are trying to control the spread. But also you have the situation they are in the world. We are talking about South Africa being part of African countries where supply of jobs hasn't happened. We saw during G7 meeting in Europe, promises made through COVAX, which is a facility for World Health Organization to supply, you know, COVID pandemic jobs into Africa. That is not happening as well. And therefore, with no promise of jobs coming on the ground, because the mechanism doesn't seem to be working, the global mechanism, and also with also the rising numbers, I think South Africa is doing the right thing to take measures to control the spread. And of course, we attribute this to the latest Delta variant, and in South Africa and many countries in Africa now, it's the third wave.
In France, partial results indicate that the center's ruling party of President Macron and his far-right rivals have both suffered defeat in regional elections runoff. Macron's party could not even break into double figures nationwide. The far-right party of National Rally, headed by Marine Le Pen, failed to win power in any of the 13 regions. By contrast, traditional parties, that's the right-wing party of the Republicans and the Socialist Party, performed well. The turnout was estimated to be 34%. Sunday's runoff was held after last week's first round did not see any party win over 50%. The regional elections come ahead of next year's presidential vote. I'm moving on, the death toll from a 12-story building collapse in the U.S. city of Surfside, Florida, has risen to 9. Search and rescue operations are underway for more than 150 others who are still missing. 3 days after the incident, crews are yet to find any sign of life. The building was built in 1981. It was undergoing a recertification process requiring repairs. A 2018 report by a consultant engineer had warned about major structural damage to the building. The residential complex had more than 130 units, some 80 of which were occupied. The Miami-Dade County officials say that all buildings more than 40 years old will be audited to ensure their safety. Colin Campbell joined us earlier with the latest on the Surfside incident.
Well, we know that what is coming out is that it cost about $10 million to repair some of the damages that have been sustained by this building over the past several years. We also know that people have complained about the integrity of the building before, providing some skepticism over whether or not the building was sound. But there was some delay in trying to get contractors to come and actually look at the building in completion. There was some patchwork that was done, but nothing to the level that they would have needed to make repairs to the foundation of the building, particularly around the pool, when it comes to the size of the building and the urgency of which it needed to be repaired. We know that around 10 people have been found. I believe the latest count was 9, and there was a 55-unit place that had collapsed. And so investigators are looking as to all the different clues as to what caused the collapse, but also who was at fault for the negligence in the reparations of this building. A lot of rubble at this site. Crews have been trying to take away various aspects of concrete and rebar and all of the other building materials that have gone into it, but there's still plenty more there. We have to remember that this was 55 different units, and they are trying to recover bodies at the same time, so they can't be reckless in scooping up all the debris and bringing it along. They have to be very meticulous in the way they go through it and discard it, because there are still human bodies that are being discovered within the rubble.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
According to the latest U.S. drought monitor, nearly 91% of the U.S. western region is in some level of drought, affecting over 58 million people. That includes nearly 56% of the region being in extreme or exceptional drought, the monitor's most severe classifications. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Temps Soar, Over 90% of Western U.S. Gripped by Drought. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. over 90% of the U.S. West is currently experiencing drought, federal authorities said recently amid warnings of unprecedented and dangerous heat heading to the Pacific Northwest and fresh declarations that humanity is in the midst of a climate emergency. According to the latest U.S. Drought Monitor, nearly 91% of the western region is in some level of drought, affecting over 58 million people. That includes nearly 56% of the region being in extreme or exceptional drought, the monitor's most severe classifications. The West has never seen a drought like this, especially so early in the dry season, tweeted meteorologist and author Eric Haltus, sharing a post from climate journalist Brian Kahn. We are in a climate emergency. The monitor described a worsening crisis. The drought situation in the western United States continued to worsen after another mostly hot and dry week. A few areas of drought in south central and southeast New Mexico saw some slight improvement due to effects from several rain and thunderstorm events in the last month. Unfortunately, widespread severe or worse drought continued in New Mexico, and conditions remained the same or worsened elsewhere. Increases in moderate, severe, extreme, and in a few cases exceptional drought coverage occurred in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and Montana. Severe drought also expanded in western Idaho. Wildfires and increasing wildlife danger, water restrictions, and damage to agriculture are very common across the West region. As far as drought goes, this is the big one, especially if we are talking about the broader drought across the whole Southwest. Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, told Bloomberg, adding, by a lot of metrics, it is the most severe drought on record. The parched conditions come alongside the National Weather Service's warning of a dangerous heat wave with record-breaking temperatures projected for the Pacific Northwest and into Southern California this weekend and into the next week. Temperatures could soar well into record-breaking territory, the agency said, with Washington and Oregon expected to see temperatures in the 90s and triple digits, 20 to 30 degrees above average. Human health will be at risk, the service said. Several high temperature records should fall throughout the Northwest, with monthly and even all-time records in jeopardy by the upcoming days. Excessive heat warnings have been issued for nearly all of Washington and Oregon, as well as much of Idaho and North California. Heat of this magnitude can be extremely dangerous if proper precautions aren't taken. Residents are urged to stay hydrated, avoid extended amounts of time outdoors, and stay in air-conditioned rooms. Nighttime temperatures are only expected to briefly cool into the 70s throughout the lower elevations, which can significantly increase the threat for heat-related illnesses. The National Interagency Fire Center says there are 54 large fires currently burning and has moved the fire preparedness level to 4 out of the 5. The second earliest level has increased to 4 since 1990. drought is also driven by La Nina conditions, which were in place through winter 2020 to 2021. NOAA noted that there is evidence climate change has played a hand in creating this reality, with heat waves occurring more often and lasting longer since 1960s, and temperatures rising steadily due to the release of greenhouse gases. Scientists warned last year that the worst-ever climate-spurred mega-droughts could devastate the West U.S. based on 1,200 years of tree ring data, modern weather observations, and 31 advanced climate models. Going back more than 1,000 years, there is evidence that naturally driven mega-droughts have laid waste to the region several times, often leading to social upheavals among indigenous civilizations. Residents have been told to brace for impact and are advised to take precautionary measures this summer to help protect themselves from a myriad of worries. Grasshoppers, which thrive in warm and arid weather, have taken over and are beginning to denude trees. A number of cities in Utah have banned fireworks ahead of the 4th of July, worried about sparking devastating wildfires. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildfire is reportedly considering relocating some fish species to save them and doing away with bag limits for recreational anglers. New Mexico parks have closed boat ramps throughout the state as reservoirs dry up. Water supply is a common problem across the West, with 1,500 critical California reservoirs lower than half of what they should be this time of year, and Idaho water managers cutting off irrigation flows to farmers. Thousands of farmers in the Golden State have been warned that they could face a similar fate.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The United States says that if a seven-year authorization from the United Nations expires, which allows trucks to go from Turkey to Syria at the Bab al-Hawa crossing, the humanitarian situation will deteriorate in Syria's Idlib region. Now, Syria and Russia say the U.S. and Turkey are using the excuse of sending in humanitarian aid to, in reality, supply terrorist groups. Russia says it will veto this authorization at the UN if Washington tries to have it reinstated. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what all of this means on this debate. We're going to cross over to Damascus and start all of this off with Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Muhammad Ali, tell us overall about this situation and what is being said.
Yes, unfortunately, if you ask the Syrians on the streets, even If Russia vetoes this resolution, the United States seems that it will continue using such a method in order to bring in so-called humanitarian aid into Syria, because the United States never abided by international law or the UN Charter and its resolution. It's occupying, for example, parts of Syria. Turkey also is occupying parts of Syria and is supporting directly Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, also known as al-Nusra Front. Now, we have Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad, who said in a televised interview that Washington's policy on cross-border aid is pure hypocrisy, and those efforts, their efforts of the United States to keep the crossing over there operational, are just another attempt to help the terrorists and provide them with all the necessary equipment to prolong the war in Syria. And Maqdad confirmed that the border crossing activities, not just the aid by Turkey and the United States, are a violation of Syria's sovereignty, and weapons are actually being sent under the pretext of humanitarian aid to those terrorists. For example, I met a terrorist and interviewed him while he was going out via bus in 2018 from Eastern Ghouta into Idlib. I interviewed him, and he said that all of the terrorist groups there are thieves, and they used to take all of the humanitarian aid that comes from Western countries for themselves and for their families, and do not distribute them to the civilians. Maqdad also finally said that if the Western countries really care about Syrians, they should lift their sanctions that are preventing Syria from getting food and medical supplies for the Syrians.
Right, indeed. Thanks so much for that update. That's Mohammed Ali, Press TV's correspondent out of Damascus. I'd like to welcome my guests, one of my guests to the program, Mark Taliano, activist and author of Voices from Syria out of Hamilton, Ontario. Thanks so much for being with us. What do you make of all of this? On the one hand, the UN is saying that they need to be able to extend this authorization in order to make sure that the humanitarian needs of people are met in Idlib. On the other hand, we see something that seems to be different, and we're hearing something totally different from the Syrian government as well as the Russian government. Your take?
Well, it's supreme war criminality is what it is. And there are a lot of complicit parties in this, including the UN, and including the Western media cartels, who obscure the truth from Western domestic audiences. It's very it should be common knowledge, simply because Western officials have admitted that they support al-Qaeda. Idlib is a al-Qaeda central. Okay, Brett McGirt admitted it's the largest AQ haven since 9/11. U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey just admitted al-Qaeda is a U.S. asset. Okay, there's nothing new about this. We have been documenting this for since before the beginning of this regime change war, and regime change wars are supreme international crimes. And so this is happening beneath the purview of the United Nations. It's happening with the support of Canada and other coalition countries that are waging criminal war against Syria. The citizens in Idlib are basically being held hostage by al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorists. And this has been happening throughout the war. The terrorists will hoard the food given to them by the West, including Canada, and they will extort money from the Syrian citizens. This is why Syrians reject this regime change war. This is why Syrians overwhelmingly support their president against U.S. Imperialism and U.S.-led imperialism and against the U.S. coalition terrorists.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let me welcome my next guest out of Damascus, international lawyer Arnaud Davili. Thank you so much for being with us. Your take on this overall situation of what is being said and what is actually happening, because on the one hand, Syria is saying that, you know, their territory is occupied. That is illegal, and is illegal according to the United Nations. It should be. And also that, one, U.S. and Turkey should get off of Syrian soil. The United States is in parts of Syria that, of course, is oil-rich and controlling much of the oil and also much of the agricultural sector. Why don't we see more interaction from the United Nations when dealing with Syria's sovereignty?
Well, I would say that the UN is actually not acting neutral. The UN has been instrumentalized for years now, not only in Syria, but in other theaters of operations. The latest instance being the inscription of Ansarallah on the so-called shame list by Gutierrez at the exact same moment when Gutierrez was running for a second term. And in that respect, the IAEA has also been instrumentalized. The OPCW has also been instrumentalized. So what we're seeing is basically a disintegration of the international order as exemplified by the UN. But at the same time, the UN being the only sole legitimate organization upon which the world community, and not the international community, as it were, has been relying on for the last 75 years, the Russians, just to cite a party among others, has been trying to retain a legalistic approach to things and bring to the fore the issues that, to begin with, humanitarian assistance should not be politicized. And this is what we've seen here with this
So what does that mean? Sorry to jump in here. So what exactly does that mean? You say basically the world order is basically disintegrating, but then on the other hand, the United Nations is the legitimate representative of nations. So where does that leave nations, for example, like Syria, whose rights, of course, are being trampled on by some of the main players in the world, and it seems even that supported by the UN.
Well, it means that the only way that Syria has to reclaim his right, and that includes the territories in the Idlib province and the northeast, is to mount resistance. Nothing else will do, because the force of arms on the ground will dictate the terms of a political settlement. As simple as that.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead, Mark. You wanted to say something.
Well, I agree. I agree. Unfortunately, that's the only thing that will work at this juncture.
Well, okay. So resistance is the only thing that will work that you're saying. But again, we're seeing, I mean, this has been going on a while now in Syria, Mark. And we're seeing then, when we look at this latest move, talking about these trucks crossing over the border from Turkey to Syria. This is nothing new, but why is it that after the United States has been involved in this situation for so long and actually has not been successful in the way they want it to, that they are just continuing to use the same playbook? What's the ultimate goal? At first it was regime change, and I'm sure they would still like to do that, but that's not likely. Is it what, just creating chaos? Is it destabilization? How do you see it?
I see this in the same terms that the former Ramsey Clark saw this, and that is that evil, invisible lobbies are controlling Washington and Western governments right now. And they're, okay, so it, Syria has strong allies. Syria has strong support from its population. And these part, some of these so-called invisible lobbies include the mainstream media cartels, which obscure the truth. We have all sorts of admissions from Washington itself that Washington supports ISIS and Al-Qaeda, okay? The mainstream media is actually a PR platform for Al-Qaeda, because the mainstream media, as an example, obscures these facts and confuses these facts. What will happen? I am confident that Syria and its allies will eventually reoccupy all of their occupied territories, and that and I am confident of this because I saw the support of Syrians for their government, and I am confident of this because Syrians know full well that any alternative is a total, complete disaster. Many Syrians, as in Syrians right now being held hostage in Western proxy, in Idlib, for example, and all the formerly terrorist occupied areas, the people who were held hostage now rejoice that they have been liberated. So they know what enslavement by Western proxies feels like, and they know what liberation feels like, and they will not forget that.
Well, what about that, Arnold? I mean, Mark talked about, as far as the mass media and basically being an extension type of PR for these terrorist groups. How should this be dealt with? Because, for example, United Nations right now is saying that 1,000 trucks are crossing the border every month and actually taking this humanitarian aid in, taking in food, and, of course, when they're talking about that on the media, it's as if now the Russians are saying that they're going to block this, as if the Russians do not want food to get to these individuals, as well as Damascus itself. So where do we stand? I mean, how do we deal with this type of wrong information that is out there coming from the mainstream media and then supported by the United Nations itself?
Yeah, you actually underlined it. I mean, the mass media, the mainstream media, as it were, is mostly an extension, a mouthpiece of the various lobbies and arms manufacturers. This is well documented. Former employees of the mass media, the mainstream media, have come out and all wrote about it. That, you know, basically they are CIA figureheads. They get their talking points, and if you deviate ever so slightly from those talking points, you're history. So it's just a job, and the propaganda is but an arm of the globalist military industrial complex. We are more than ever before in an hybrid warfare. They instrumentalized the UN, they instrumentalized the very rule of law. As we can see in various courtrooms across Europe, where everything is more like a political manipulation of political processes and legal processes. So there's not even the pretense nowadays to hide behind some formal processes which would appear to be somewhat neutral. The machine, the narrative of the machine, as I call it, is unraveling. They are facing internal contradiction that have been accumulating for the last three decades now. And the point is, what do we do? We have our own media. We have our own, the mainstream media does not have the monopoly anymore on the narrative. And we saw this in a very exemplified fashion as, 3 days ago, all 33 networks and websites of the resistance were the victim of hacking. So basically, this means only one thing, is that the truth is getting through somewhat, in spite of their billions of dollars and their nice sets and their expensive wardrobes. People are thirsty for the truth. There's a popular commonsensical approach to the way things are, whether it's about the constant permanent warfare state, or the health situation, as they call it, for the last 15 months. People are getting somewhat the idea, the hint, that there's something drastically wrong with how the media tries to portray reality and how commonsensical people get to experience it on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Mark, speaking of the media, of course, when we talk about the Bab al-Hawa checkpoint, it takes me back to especially 2014 and my good colleague, Serena Shem, here at Press TV, of course, who was reporting from there at that time and saying that UN food program trucks were being used to take in terrorists and take the equipment, supplies, into Syria, and we saw that basically nothing was said, nothing was done. Again, we're talking about the mainstream media, and of course, a couple of days later, unfortunately, Serena lost her life. So now here we are, fast forwarding 7 years later, and we're seeing this same scenario repeating itself. What has changed in those 7 years, in your perspective? 2014 to 2021 as far as the resistance and as far as the opposite axis of the resistance in Syria?
The axis of resistance, in other which the resist people who resist, countries who resist the legitimate Syrian government, they represent international law. They represent nation-state sovereignty. They represent civilization. And the West and its proxies represent barbarism. And Syria is, this is one reason why this victory for Syria is and will be so important, is because it is on the side of truth, peace, and justice. And now Syria's allies are stronger. And this hybrid war will no doubt continue, but as my colleague mentioned, there is some desperation now. They're taking websites off the air. People are seeing with this COVID op that our governments are not, Western governments themselves are not supporting the people, Western people, okay? Western people are slowly becoming aware of this. These globalists do not represent our interests. Canada is no longer a democracy. We are living beneath totalitarian rule in many respects, sometimes more than others, okay? But of course, again, the media is an arm of the, what I call the controllers. And the controllers are not the Western politicians, unfortunately. Well, the Western propositions are puppets for these globalist controllers. But it can be brought down, and Syria has shown to the world, and is showing to the world, that the forces of truth and justice and civilization can prevail and can become ascendant. And I believe that this will continue to be the case. I believe that Washington-led coalition is on its last legs there, and that Syria will regain occupied territories and its sovereignty and its independence.
Arnold, your take. I mean, I want to compare in the very beginning of the onslaught that was on Syria from these terrorists from so many countries in the world, compared from the beginning of that until now. And these two different points of this axis, again, the axis of resistance, and of course, as you said, those representing the globalists, changes since the beginning of this conflict or this onslaught till now.
Well, the changes is that over time, I mean, I always compare the Syrian situation to Stalingrad during World War II. This is like the turning of the tide, and the reason why we're seeing now this kind of insistence from the globalists in trying to press on using various means, maybe under cover of the pandemic, as I call it, well, in isolating the different composing segments of the resistance axis. They understand that if they lose this one, they're losing the whole marble. This one is for the whole marble. And this idea that China is building this new Eurasian economic sphere is terrifying them. And they're making more and more mistakes now. They seem to be in full panic, to be honest. And we might be seeing, as time goes on, an acceleration of this liquefaction process. They're going to dissolve in their own hinterland. Because the people there, when they start realizing that they've been had, that the game is up, and that they're going to be basically chipped and ran and instrumentalized as products themselves, yes. People are going to be crazy, are going crazy. People are going to blow up. I mean, when one has nothing to lose, one basically tries to take his enemy down with him. And so I think this is all coming to a head right now, and we have to remain extremely vigilant, because the beast is wounded, but the beast is never more dangerous than when it's wounded and backed against the wall.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me On this debate, Mark Taliano, activist and author, voices from Syria out of Hamilton, Ontario, and Arnaud Debele, international lawyer out of Damascus.
Thank you.
And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for staying with us. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamati, Allah my Lord,
Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon,
praise be upon,
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachu. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider, and here in the studio today, we have with us Brother Mahdi Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone who's with us, who isn't with us, and who's going to join us, and who's never going to join us.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Why are people not regretful of their mistakes? Why are the people who have hurt me not regretful?
Because you deserved to be hurt. Well, that's actually one of the reasons, you know. Sometimes we do something wrong and we justify it and we say, you know, they deserved it, you know. However bad is a thing that we've done, but we end up saying that, you know, they deserved it.
It reminds me of the hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, you know, the biggest sin is the one that you take lightly. And if we really pay, I mean, while there are greater and smaller sins, but if you really think about it, really the biggest sin is the one that we take lightly. And I'll give you an example. Nobody who does something bad, commits a mistake, a sin, a bad thing, repetitively thinks bad of it. And I want to give you the example of a serial killer.
Okay, go on.
A serial killer is somebody who has murdered innocent people one after another. And I was watching this.
Anyway, yeah, sorry.
Because a society is messed up, isn't it? If the ideals of a society dictate that you can go and kill innocent people in other countries, then it's going to affect people inside the country.
Inside the country.
And so you have, you know, so many school shootings, you have terrible things happening inside the country, including serial killers. So they were interviewing this serial killer, a famous serial killer, and I was watching the interview. The guy has no remorse at all. It's really, it makes you, you know, you feel shivers. He's saying, yeah, and then I took this person, I cut them into pieces, I put the pieces into the fridge. Yes, I hammered this person to death. And then the interviewer actually asks, did you not feel any regret? And he goes, not really. It was just something I was doing. Really.
Well, what do you mean, though?
Asfal asafaleen. We can become so low that can commit.
Man, you've gone hardcore, man. I was talking about mistakes like breaking a cup.
Well, you need to know that breaking of a cup, or, you know, little mistakes that you make, you might think that it's only small, but so does the serial killer. Right?
Yeah.
You broke your mother's heart, you hurt your dad, you hurt somebody else, you stole something, you thought it was a gradual process? Yeah, it's a gradual process. It's a slippery slope before somebody can do the worst of crimes, and they don't even... It's really scary, actually.
Was he justifying his acts or no?
He wasn't really caring about justifying it. He was, do you know?
All right, so he was far off that also.
The interviewer was asking him, "Do you know that what you did was wrong?" He's like, "Yeah, it was wrong." You know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Do you regret? Fair enough.
If he asks him, "Do you think it was? Do you regret it?" Regret? Not really.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
People go to hell, right? They go to hell.
Oh, okay, go on.
Right? When they go to hell, do they know that what they've done is wrong? Yes. Do they know that they have committed terrible sins? Yes. Do they now recognize Allah and the reality of their crimes? Yes. Do they regret it? No.
Oh, they do. They do. They do. But there's something that we want to point towards is that
they regret it. They do, but they don't have remorse for it.
I think they're too arrogant.
Right.
That the arrogance is, I think, one of the things that stops people from admitting their mistakes. Because I want to read a verse of Surah Yunus, verse 54. It says, "ولو أن أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم." It says, "ولو أن لكل نفس ظلمت ما في الأرض لفتدت به." You know, if people who have done who've been wrongful, right? They had everything that is in the earth. They is talking about the day of judgment. They would, you know, ransom it for the thing to get their sins forgiven, right? But there's one thing. وَأَصَرُّ النَّدَامَةَ لَمَّا رَأَوُ الْعَذَابِ. They hide the remorse that they have, the regret that they have when they look at when they see the punishment. وَقُضِيَ بَيْنَهُمْ بِالْقِسْطِ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ. And even that Allah azab that they have is just, and even upon those people is there's no dhulm on that day, because whatever they did, they're going to get the equivalent amount of dhulm that they had. They're going to pay for it. But the thing, the key over here is that they do have regret now, right? But they're too arrogant. They're still on the day of judgment. As you said, it's such a gradual process that, right, fair enough, once you do something, you commit an act, and you're a bit regretful and remorseful, but then you train yourself, right, to not, which isn't a very good training, to not be regretful and remorseful, right? To the extent that you are now dead. Well, like the physical death, you are now dead, and the day of judgment is here. Like everything is now open and clear now, you know, and still you've deceived yourself to such an extent that you're gonna hide your remorse when you see Allah because you've been arrogant. So I think like these small mistakes that we do not man up, in other words, and accept that it is a mistake that I've made, lead to the biggest of losses that we can face, which is the loss of our own selves, even in the hereafter. Yeah.
We come back to that, though. We're going to go for a short break.
We just have to open our eyes, our hearts and minds. If we just look right, we'll see the signs. We can't keep hiding from the truth and let it take us by surprise. Protect us in the best way. Us every single day, keep us close to you until the end of time.
Why do people not feel regret or show regret for their mistakes? Because they're arrogant, is that what we're saying?
They're arrogant. Well, they're two different things, yeah. Sometimes they're arrogant, fair enough. But other times they do not know it's a mistake. Some people do not really, genuinely do not know it's a mistake. They actually think they're doing something. They're serving humanity, whereas they haven't. They're actually, you know, hurting people. It's a mistake that they've made. And such people who are really open to learn, when they're told about their mistakes, when they're made aware, they do regret their mistakes. So we could say that potentially one of the people who, one type of those people who do not regret what they've done is because they do not know it's a mistake that they've made. And all they need is awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Others, they're too arrogant, you know? And that arrogance needs to be broken down.
Okay, so the fear here is that, you know, us, you know, we're young, we're stupid, we've made mistakes, and how do we recognize whether we're being